Let's pick up where we left off in the book of Genesis. We left off in chapter 11. Chapter 11 in the book of Genesis. Remember, when we went through chapter 10, it was basically we went through the table of nations where we saw how the population of the earth was beginning to multiply through Noah's sons. And then in this particular chapter 11, we're really going to focus in or narrow in on one particular son of Noah's. That's his son Shem, because in his genealogy or his particular line of descendants, we will be able to follow through and trace all the way down to the birth of Jesus Christ. This is why the Bible, has, basically narrowed it down to this one particular line or one particular genealogy, so they can trace back Jesus Christ's ancestry. You trace it all the way back to Adam, but it did flow right through Noah's son Shem. All right. Anyway, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 11, it says, "Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they used bricks for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they propose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord scattered them abroad from over the face of the earth, the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, or Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now, this story, I think a lot of people have heard and they're basically kind of familiar with, but also couple it with what we read in chapter 10 about a particular man named Nimrod. Okay, so when you take these two portions together, what we're beginning to see here is as man began to multiply, and let me say something before we even get into it. Now, remember that once mankind had multiplied, basically, I mean, it's been estimated that before the flood, the population of the earth was, could have conceivably been around 3 billion people. Okay, well, after the total destruction and annihilation of, life upon this planet as before the Noahian flood, a new beginning started with Noah and his family. But human nature hadn't been changed. In other words, man had a clean start in terms of his environment, okay? In terms of being able to start over again as far as the world was concerned. But nothing changed within his heart. Nothing changed within his nature. So it wasn't that much longer after the flood when men began to multiply, and they multiplied very fast because, first of all, their gene pool was very, very pure at this time still. And even though the environment has been radically altered, they were still very healthy, and they lived long ages. And as their longevity, was so much greater than ours, they could actually produce many more children in their lifespan. So it wasn't but several hundred years after the flood when mankind, the population began to basically explode, and the congregation of men at that particular time began to migrate eastward, and I don't know if you can see it on this particular map here, but they began to migrate towards this area known as Babylon, because it says in the plains of Shinar. Once they got to the plains of Shinar, which is Babylon, of course, and it's in modern-day Iraq right now, but this political leader, this man named Nimrod, he was their first king. And the Bible describes him as being a mighty hunter before the Lord, and that title is kind of ambiguous, but it kind of suggests that he was able to galvanize, a whole population of people and to be their political leader and to basically, lead them in the direction he wanted them to go. And he decided, look, what's the point in being scattered all over the face of the earth? Why don't we do something that's going to build a name for ourselves and unify us and give us a rallying point and galvanize us in such a way that we will be one big population that just doesn't have to, you know, endure any hardships in terms of migrating anywhere else on the earth. So this was basically their plan, and it was under a man named Nimrod, because we are told that after that God confounded the language, we know that Nimrod, he went further up north, leaving Babylon, he went up to Assyria, and that's where he founded the city of Nineveh. Okay, so you keep this all in mind, and you put it all together like a big puzzle, but there are a couple things that I think are really worth noting, and that's the fact that, hey, even though man was given another chance, it wasn't much longer after his second chance that he began to basically rebel against God, because God had given this very specific commandment to not only to be fruitful and multiply, but, you know, it was God's intention that man take complete dominion of the earth. And in order to do that, they had to scatter themselves abroad as far as the face of the earth was concerned. And I went over this the other day. I went over this last week, or the week before last, as far as, you know, the Table of Nations was concerned. And it's really strongly believed, certainly through Scripture, but also through a lot of the theories now that are coming out, that they seem to be substantiated pretty well as far as the world was concerned, that there used to be one big, massive supercontinent. Okay? Because if you go all the way back to almost the first chapter of Genesis, when God said that he separated the water from the dry land, and he said the dry land appeared. In other words, it was talking about the dry land being in a singular form. And many of the geologists today and people who have really studied the continents today believe that at one particular time in the past, there was one big, massive supercontinent. And like I said, if you look at these maps that I have up here, you can look at this sphere of the earth, and you can almost see that it fits together almost like a puzzle in terms of being one big supercontinent. Well, it was during the days of Peleg that the earth was divided. Now, some people have just assumed that that meant, well, that it was during his day that the language was confounded. But I believe that if you look at it, it's saying that the earth actually, you know, the continents actually split apart. And one of the things that the major factor in the cause of the continent splitting apart was, you got to go back to the Noahian flood, where the Bible tells us that the fountains of the deep broke open. Okay, in other words, there was right now, even today, there's 50 times more water, fresh water underground than there is fresh water above ground. But it says that the fountains of the deep broke open. And so, in other words, the fountains of the deep, however they broke, they tore up, they actually just tore the entire supercontinent or landmass apart. It was several hundred years after the flood that the continents began to drift apart. Now, we are told, if you go down to any library, you will read about the continental drift theory. And the only argument I have with that particular theory is that, to them, it says it took something like 600 million years. Well, obviously it didn't. This happened from the catastrophic flood that actually resulted in the splitting of the continents. And so now, instead of one big, massive supercontinent, what we have is we've got seven different continents. We've got North America, South America, Australia, Antarctica, Africa, Europe, and Asia. And I think I mentioned this before, too. If you go into the book of Revelation, you will read that the big red dragon, which is Satan, has seven heads to him. And seven is the number of totality, the number of perfection. We also read that the beast, the Antichrist, has seven heads. And those heads, I believe, represent the seven continents of the world. In other words, he's going to have complete and total dominion and control over the entire face of the globe. All right? But at one particular time in history, about 2,000 years after Adam, the flood happened, and then the earth became divided. All right? And even today, we know that there is that continental drift, that the continents are drifting apart from each other just a few inches a year. Okay? But at that particular time, thousands of years ago, this was a massive upheaval. Okay? This, too, was part of a judgment from God. Okay? As far as the separation was concerned. But now look what he says here in this verse 11, chapter 11. The whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Okay, the land of Shinar is a land of Babylon, all right? That was where man's rebellion began. And in his pride and in his arrogance and in his stubbornness and in his stiff-neckedness, he decided, hey, I'm going to build a big, huge monument. He wanted to build a big, massive tower that reached into heaven. Now, obviously, they weren't that stupid to think that they were going to build something that's going to go into the outer space and then God's throne room. But what it was they wanted to build a massive tower on this particular plain that could be seen for miles and miles around. And apparently this tower was some kind of ziggurat or some kind of pyramid that they were going to put a temple at the top of it. Because we know that if we look at some of these ancient civilizations that have been unearthed today, you see these pyramids or you see these various towers that they had built thousands of years ago, and many of them had a temple on top of them, and they used that platform at the top to chart the movement of the stars. And basically this was the introduction of the false religious system. Because if you go to the book of Revelation, we are told that there is the mother of all harlots is Babylon, and that's where this all began, was in the plains of Shinar. The plains of Shinar are Babylon. She was referred to as the mother of harlots because that's where she gave birth to false religious systems, occultic practices, to New Age philosophies, to all kinds of idolatry, all kinds of godless forms of sorcery, witchcraft. All of these things had its origin right there in the plains of Shinar. That's where it all began. And apparently it began under this one very charismatic leader named Nimrod. And he's the one that basically was responsible for galvanizing these people into a kind of, arrogant disregard for God's specific intention or will in terms of men multiplying and then spreading out over the face of all the earth. Okay, so he says that they all had one language, all right? And God comes down and he looks at this situation. They're building this massive, huge tower as well as a city. And look at the way it's worded because I think it's very, very instructive. I think it's very significant. Because in verse 3 it says, and they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. Now, the plain of Shinar, they couldn't find used big, massive boulders or rocks or things like that to be quarried. They just, made bricks and burned them thoroughly. In other words, heated them in such a way that they were able to use them as building blocks for their purposes. And it says in verse 4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city, a tower, whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the earth. Now, that's kind of interesting. You see a great deal of human pride here, don't you? And it says, let us, let us, let us. It's interesting. I'm going to get into this in just a minute. But when God comes down and he decides to confound the language, he says, let us confound their language. When God is speaking, he's speaking in that triune Godhead, the Trinity, three distinct personages in this Trinity. But here's man saying, let us do this and let us do this, 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 this. I think it's very significant that even today, even concerning a lot of the work that's going on, even in the church today, you've got to almost like look at it and just say, okay, is this really being done for the honor and glory of God? Is it really being done for the salvation of souls and the edification of his church? I have no way of knowing, and I'm certainly not going to try to pass judgment upon anyone or any minister or any church or any organization. But I'll tell you, I look around sometimes and I see some of these structures that are going up or that have been built in the name of the Lord, but I can't help but just see that there's a hint of human pride behind it, that it's built in such a way that the person's got their name all over it to kind of build themselves a name. Well, all I'm saying is this. Whatever we do in the expenditure of our human energy, money, time, effort, or whatever, if it's meant for our own glory, it's going to come to nothing. It's going to be confounded. But if everything that we do is done out of love for God and love for souls and a desire to exalt his name, then it's going to remain forever. We are even warned of this. We are told of this in the New Testament that Paul warns us. He warns us in a book in one of the epistles of the Corinthians where he says that, hey, every man's work is someday going to be tested. It's going to go through the fire. And he says, if it doesn't, you know, pass the test of the fire, everything's going to be burned up. All of his works are going to be burned up. He himself may be saved by, as though through fire, in other words, by the skin of his teeth. But all the work that he did on earth in the name of quote-unquote Jesus Christ is going to be burned up if it really wasn't done for the honor and glory of Jesus Christ. In other words, we don't know how deceitful our hearts can be, how desperately wicked they are. And sometimes, you know, people will be out there building with wood, hay, and stubble rather than with the right materials. In other words, they're out there building, you know, for their own glory, their own recognition, or they're out there, you know, doing things that God never commissioned them to do. I see this in a lot of churches today where they seem to expend a lot of time and effort and money and energy doing what? Trying to tear down other Christian denominations, or to undermine them, or to you know, expose them for whatever reason. And I think that this is building with all the wrong materials and with all the wrong motives. But if you go into Corinthians again, in Corinthians 13, it says that, hey, if we do things out of the right motive, if we do out of love for God, that's what's going to remain. Well, here's the contrast, because in verse 6 it says, and the Lord said, or actually start with verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. Now nothing which they propose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Now, he comes down, and he basically evaluates the situation and says, look what they've determined to do, okay? And God makes a statement here that I think is very, very insightful, or very, very curious to me, because he says that whatever they put their mind to, they're going to be able to do. Okay, and he can see that he can see the handwriting on the wall, that this really spells trouble, because whatever they put their mind to, they can accomplish. And if you go back and you look over, you know, past history, it always amazes me how many times that the modern day scientists and geologists and anthropologists and all these people will look back on ancient civilizations, and time and time and time and time again, they will say that, well, we don't understand how these primitive people were able to build such massive structures like the pyramids of Egypt, or the pyramids down in Mexico, or these massive, huge figureheads, these monolith statues on Easter Island. There's over 1,000 of them, you know. Where did all these things come from? How could such people with such limited resources and intelligence and have any ability whatsoever to be able to accomplish such incredible feats? We dismiss it as being a mystery. But we forget one thing, that these people lived 2,000 years after Adam. They were 2,000 years down the gene pool. So in other words, their gene pool had not become as polluted and as messed up as ours is today. When we get down to Abraham married his half-sister, okay? Well, God's Mosaic law at that particular time did not come into play until after Moses came onto the scene, okay? But when Moses came on the scene, then God gave a law and says, you're not to marry your sister or your brother or your first cousin. You know, you're not to intermarry within the family. You know, that this was strictly forbidden by God. Well, God didn't explain to people, well, the reason is because of the gene pool and what is known as gene stacking. In other words, if you married your sister or you married your brother, well, you come from the same set of parents, and let's just say you're both carrying a gene, let's just say a poor eyesight. You know, well, your offspring is more likely going to have that. Or, worse yet, you're both carrying the gene of, you know, some kind of disease, whether it be cancer or whether it be something, your chances of having an offspring that's going to be, you know, either deformed mentally, emotionally, spiritually, or physically, becomes, you know, greatly multiplied. Anyway, so what God has said is that these people had proposed to do this, and he says nothing can stop them now. In other words, what I was trying to drive at is that I really believe these people had tremendous intelligence. In spite of the fact that they were 2,000 years removed from Adam, they still had tremendous insight, tremendous ability, tremendous intelligence, where they could do tremendous things that we look back and we wonder, how could these primitive people accomplish what they've done? Well, God, you know, made man in his image and likeness. As a matter of fact, in the Psalms, and Jesus even quoted it in the New Testament, he said that we are gods. Now, I gotta qualify this, okay? This is what the Mormons teach, and I'm not teaching we are gods, but, you know, this is what the Scripture does say, and Jesus referred to it as being such. In other words, we are the offspring of God. So, in other words, you know, God, by his nature, is very creative, okay? And he has instilled this as well as in man. And God could see that, okay, if man is one language and he's got one purpose, you know, there's nothing going to stop him. He can do whatever he wants to do. So God put a stop to that by judging them and confounding their languages. Okay? Now, it's amazing when you think of that, what that must have looked like. I don't know how many people, they were probably in the millions at this particular time. Okay? Because I know that I just read a statistic the other day that says that there's 12 million Bibles a year that are sold throughout the world. And they are sold in 1,062 different languages. I mean, there was probably more than that God had confounded. From one language, he probably made 2,000 languages to force people to separate. So can you imagine? They're out there trying to build this massive tower, and then all of a sudden, nobody could understand each other. You want to ask for a hammer? You want to ask for, you know, a saw? You want to ask for a nail? I mean, and they're all looking at you like, you know, what are you talking about? And it must have been hilarious to look at. I mean, if you think about it. But at the same token, it was very, very tragic. Now, the people, you know, they obviously were in such mass confusion. That's why they call it the Tower of Babel. Babel means confusion. Can you imagine it? Several hundred thousand people, maybe even in the millions, and all of a sudden you've got thousands of different languages, and people don't know, trying to find anybody they can communicate with. You talk about mass confusion. I mean, it must have been kind of humorous. And so finally, when people would connect with somebody they could understand, you know, they stuck to them like glue, because everything else was just a massive, confusion. And so finally, you know, when the groups began to pair off, they said, well, we understand each other. We don't understand them. Let's get out of here. And so, you know, what happened is that God forced them to disperse, you know, throughout the world, throughout this one supercontinent. Okay? It was his intention that they pioneer and go throughout the world by themselves. Now he forces them to. But see the judgment that brought, all right, upon mankind? Now look at us today. We are separated by, you know, hundreds of different languages. But there's only one thing that's going to unify us. Remember what happened on the day of Pentecost when Peter stood up and began to preach about, you know, Jesus Christ and him crucified and his resurrection? It says that many of the people that were listening to him preach or listening to the other apostles, as they began to speak in different tongues, they were beginning to understand in their own language. You know, the common denominator of Jesus Christ having died on the cross and rose from the grave, you know, to forgive us of our sins and our need of repentance and our need to commit ourselves to him. So in other words, Pentecost was almost a foreshadow of what is actually prophesied in the book of Zephaniah. I think it's the third chapter, 19th verse or 9th verse or something like that, where it says that there's coming a day when there will be a pure language. And that pure language is interpreted to mean that there will one day be, again in the future, one language for all mankind. I believe that day will be not during the millennial period. I believe it will be during the eternal state. Okay. The reason I say I don't believe it would be in the millennial period when Christ reigns for 1,000 years is because we know that the nations are still separated. The nations will still be the way they are in terms of there'll still be that separation as far as nations. But then they'll, for the eternal state, there's going to be just mankind are going to be brought back to one, you know, bond, and I believe even under one language. But can you see the far-reaching effects of this judgment? I mean, I don't think any of us can even begin to plumb the depths of it in our imagination as far as what it must have been like as far as their potential being able all to speak the same language. They got one world. They got one world leader, Nimrod. Okay, they got one purpose. They all getting together as far as their human pride and their arrogance. Hey, we're going to do this together. We're going to make our name for ourselves. We're going to be this and that and the other thing. And God just comes down, confounds their languages, and throws them in total chaos, total confusion. You know, it must have taken them weeks to separate the mess, to find out who belongs to who. Can you imagine it?
Huh? Turning into somebody that understands you and you understand it. Yeah. I was going crazy.
Yeah, right.
You understand? It must be thinking everybody else is gone crazy.
Right. I mean, it just must have been hilarious. Yeah. I mean, if you could kind of picture it in your mind. I mean, I try to do that. I say, man, it must have been so confusing. That's what I call it, the confounding of tongues. You know, it's like every one of us in this room, and there's only a dozen of us in this room, trying to understand each other. We're all speaking different languages. I mean, we're probably using sign language, everything, and there's probably been frustrations, there's probably been fights and people throwing things at one another. I mean, that was the beginning of the nations, right? So now they got the United Nations there in New York, and it's the same thing. You know, they got everybody in the United Nations, they all got these earphones on so that they can hear the person speaking. They can all hear it in their own language. I don't know how many people realize that, but every time I see that, I say, that's the judgment. That's from a judgment from God. But people don't realize it. They don't recognize it. They don't see it for what it is. You know, that we can't understand each other. And I tell you right now, the only thing that's going to bring us back to under one roof is the cross. The cross is the great lever. It's only Jesus Christ. It's only through Him that we're going to become one people again. But anyway, let's just kind of wind this down, because it says that verse 17. It says, come, let us go down and there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Now, here it says, again, look at that verse 17, let us. Now, this is God speaking. God, singular, saying, let us. God, plural. So it's God the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit saying what? Let's go down and confuse their language. Verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. These are the records of the genealogies of Shem. Okay, now we're just going to read this. I try to get through this as quickly as I can. Like I said, when you get into the genealogies, it's really frustrating, especially with some of these tongue-twisting names. But let's go through this, because this genealogy was put here for a very specific purpose. It's to show the line of Christ as it descends right from Adam. Now, granted, there may have been a generation or so that was skipped, because there are some variations in some genealogies, but it shows a continuous line, regardless of how you cut it, through Abraham right down to the birth of Jesus Christ. So it says here, and Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpachshad, and he had other sons and daughters. And Arpachshad lived 35 years and became the father of Shelah. And Arpachshad lived 403 years after he became the father of Shelah, and he had other sons and daughters. And Shelah lived 30 years and became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived for 403 years after he became the father of Eber, and he had other sons and daughters. And Eber lived 35 years and became the father of Peleg. And Eber lived 430 years after he became the father of Peleg, and he had other sons and daughters. Now, when we're talking about Peleg here, we're talking about, when you read in that chapter 10, it was that particular individual. It was during his lifespan. It was during his life that the earth was divided. I have some of these charts that I kind of put together here, but if you look at the charts, you will find that actually the division of the earth, or the nations, or the continents, actually began to split up in his lifetime, which was really about 2,000 years after, the creation of Adam. That's when the continents began, that God divided the earth, all right, in this particular man's lifetime. And then in verse 18 it says, and Peleg lived 30 years and became the father of Reu, and Peleg lived 209 years after he became the father of Reu, and he had other sons and daughters. And Reu lived 32 years and became the father of Serug. And Reu lived 200 years and 7 years after he became the father of Serug, and he had other sons and daughters. And Serug lived 35 years and became the father of Nahor. And Serug lived 200 years after he became the father of Nahor, and he had other sons and daughters. Nahor lived 29 years and became the father of Terah. And Nahor lived 119 years after he became the father of Terah, and he had other sons and daughters. And Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the records of the genealogies of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, Haran, Haran, and Haran became the father of Lot. Now, before we wind this chapter down, just let me make a few comments about what we read as far as these genealogies. I think, you know, this list that we just read from Shem, we were talking about how the lifespan begins to go down. And I think it's interesting. Adam lived 930 years. Seth lived 912 years. Enosh lived 905 years. Kenan lived 910 years. Mahalalel lived 895 years, and Jared lived 962 years. And then Enoch, he lived 365 years, but he was taken. He didn't die. He was taken by the Lord. So then you go from Enoch, you go to Methuselah, and he lived 969 years. So in other words, the lifespan is, you see, for over the first 1,000 years, over 1,000 years, was almost a 1,000-year lifespan. Because from Methuselah, then you go to Lamech, and Lamech, now the age begins to drop down a little bit. Lamech was 777 years. But Noah lived a total of 950 years. Okay, then after the flood, we've got a change of environment. The gene pool is now becoming more and more polluted. And now watch how the longevity begins to drop. Because we go to Shem, who lives 602 years, we just read this, to Arpachshad, who lives 438 years, to Shelah, to 433 years, to Eber, who 464 years, to Peleg, who lived 239 years, and to Reu, 239 years, and Serug, 230 years, and Nahor, 148 years, and Terah, 205 years, and then he becomes the father of Abraham. Abraham lives 175 years, becomes the father of Isaac, who lived 180 years, and then he becomes the father of Jacob, who lives 147 years. So you see a gradual decline in the longevity of man, the longer that man stays on earth, because not only because of the gene pools becoming more and more polluted as you go down, but also because of the environment. After the Noahian flood, it's no longer conducive to longevity. So now here we are, and you know, 6,000 years apart from Adam, and our best hope is to somewhere between 70 and 80. Now, granted, there are a number of people. Matter of fact, I think there's around something like 60,000 people in this country alone who are over 100. Okay, but when you figure that 60,000 in comparison to the overall number of people on in this nation or in the world, it's nothing. So, what I'm saying is, it's the average lifespan now. And the most technologically advanced societies hovers right between 70 and 80 years. But now, just in conclusion, now it gets into Abraham and now his descendants. Back up to that verse 27. Now, these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. Okay. And then it says, and Haran died in the presence of his father in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves, and the name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Michal, and the daughter of Haran, and the father of Michal, and Iscah. And Sarah was barren, and she had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son, Abraham's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Cana. And they went as far as Haran, and they settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Okay, now basically what it's telling us here in the conclusion of this chapter is that here they are. Ur is way southeast of Babylon. It's probably
almost 150 miles or 100 miles from Babylon. So they start their journey, and they start to go to Cana. But on the way to Cana, they stop at Haran. And Haran's right up here, if you can see it on the map, okay? So they make a trip, probably almost about 800 miles. And then they stop in Haran, but there Terah dies. There Abraham's father dies. And then there at Haran, the Lord appears to Abraham and tells him to go into the land of Cana, because there he's going to give him that particular land, which of course that we know of as Israel today. But anyway, we'll be getting into that when I get back from New York, as far as, you know, what transpires then. But does anybody have anything they want to add or share to what we read tonight?
No.